So maybe he will still come. Here's Mr. Hanger and Lois. They're coming. Good. For those of you who don't know, Warren Hagstrom had a bicycle accident. But he's obviously better. And Lois Hagstrom had surgery, and she's obviously better. Are there other announcements? Dorothy, what is your first
name? She's a good Presbyterian who just gets drinking coffee during church. She drinks coffee all the time otherwise. And John asked us in Erica Magazine to sign the book this morning, and I said I would.
Well, you took the words right out of the membership committees. John, we're glad to have you all this morning. How are you?
I have an announcement please yet. There are some ski boots and some ice skates which will mold in the basement. These were some that some of us brought to sell and weren't sold. So I've put them up under the membership table back there. If they're yours, you could take them home until next fall. Some of them are mine. I'll take them.
Are there further announcements?
Well, there's a safe flight in the parking lot in case somebody misses.
Yeah, it says park control. It's mine. I'm sorry. All that I was trying to park it, and I just think it's going back out.
Do you carry that sign with you all the time?
I have a whole series of ones.
Flowers, which are written in the corner up here, and another. van had boards.
That's a crazy quilt over in the corner. Representative of prayer. Robinson Sink number 27, if you can look up. Morning, so curious. Scientists are beginning to feel that
there may be other planets in which forms of life exist. Now, Christian says that life may be, the idea that life may be universal is based on a number of points. First, the simple fact that the chemical components necessary for life are found throughout the universe. There are just a couple of basic chemicals which you needed to be combined into life forms, and that they are uniform throughout the universe. He says that since all the required ingredients are abundantly available throughout the universe, life can and will have evolved, given sufficient time, wherever a congenial environment should happen to exist. In other words, given the assumption that the evolutionary process takes place on a universal basis, there is no reason that advanced higher life forms will not have evolved from these basic chemical substances. There is no valid rationale, therefore, by which we can continue to hold that as an intelligent organism, human beings are unique in the universe, or that the cosmos turns and struggles for our particular benefit and salvation. And I think this is as mind-shattering a discovery scientifically as the original discovery that the sun didn't go around the earth. The whole idea that the earth was not the center of the entire known universe was very, very shattering to people's minds when it was discovered. It made people very nervous to suddenly realize that the earth was not the center of the universe, that everything didn't turn on the earth. And similarly, I think throughout the world, there's a particular kind of shattering of feeling of security going on from the fact that people, it's beginning to penetrate people's minds that we may not be the master race, that human beings may not be the greatest achievement in the entire cosmos, but that indeed it's perfectly possible that something up there is a little brighter than we are. The meaning of human existence changes. If you take yourself to belong to a biocosmos in which other life forms may exist, as advanced or as intelligent as oneself. High life forms may exist that, judged by specific qualities of perception and consciousness, are our peers and our superiors. It is with this recognition that you come out really in two different places psychologically. One, the idea which is accompanying idea, that we are not alone, you see, in the cosmos. And the other, which is an uncomfortable idea, if we're not alone, who is there with us? And this is why you have the great rise in the world of fiction, of literature, and also poetry, of what is called science fiction. Because the people just do not sit still with the things that filter down to them. Human beings are always trying to give meaning to something. And for the past 50, 60 years, and even starting in the 19th century, and some speculations in the 17th and 18th century, literary people, novelists and fiction writers and poets, have been saying, what if the other worlds are like this? Or what if the other worlds are like that? And any of you who are science fiction buffs know that a lot of it is made up of really three different things. Scientific material, which is really quite true to whatever it is, quantum theory, chemical analysis, or whatever. A tremendous concentration on ethics and morals. Human beings making decisions in odd ways and out-of-the-way places. It kind of fills a hunger we have for ethical and moral writing. And then pure speculation about the meaning of the universe, about metaphysics, in which the mind ranges over possibilities. The point at which I disagree with the analysis of the humanist is that the scientists say, well, until we had all these objective facts, we've had to use myths. The connotation of myth is untrue. And now that some of these things are becoming scientifically provable, we don't need to have all these untruths anymore. Now, where I disagree with that is that I think that myths are a projection, potentially a prophetic projection, a speculation using the human imagination, using scientific facts, also a speculation about what the universe may indeed be like, so that we project meaning onto the universe through our stories, and that there may be more meaning in our stories than there are in facts. I always think of to one of my students at Spelman College in Georgia, who was supposed to write a short story for me, and she came and she said, I'll tell you, I've got a really good basis for a short story. I had these seven uncles, and each one in turn, about a three-year period, became alcoholic, and each one in turn, in about a four-year period, stripped himself naked in an alcoholic fit and went out and froze to death in the snow. And I said, well, that just won't do for a short story. And she said, why? It's true. And I said, I don't care if it's true or not. It doesn't tell me anything about human mind. You've got to rearrange it and maybe change it a little bit to tell me something about the substance of human mind. Fiction rearranges fact. Well, we finally got it straightened out that they all were, I think it was Oedipally fixated on their mother or something. I can't remember quite what it was. And we somehow got that thing rearranged so that it was a real story. But it didn't matter to me that what she was telling me was true. Fiction to me was different than truth and involved the rearrangements of the elements of truth, which is why I think I irritate a lot of you with my mixtures of science and myth, because human beings in this state of mind speculate and play, and this is kind of a playful thing. And in conjunction with that very metaphysical thought, we're going to have some music of the spheres. A really magnificent first appearance of the duet, George and Ruth Calden playing Domino Deus. Is that right? Domino Deus, or Domino Dea, Domino Deus. From Vivaldi's Lorca Mass on mandolin and recorder.
With no orchestra.
I'm the orchestra, and she's the soprano solo voice.
I call it the spheres.
I call it the music of the spheres. They didn't know I was going to call it.
Thank you.
I must apologize to you, we've been a little bit irresponsible. We've managed to lose some of the original National Geographics we took them from. So I will have a little poetic license. I've forgotten what country this lady comes from, although she fulfills my theme. I have a few quotations here from my favorite magazine, The Country Woman, which says that the spiritual is a dimension of a person that is just as real as the physical dimension, but it shows itself to us in different ways. Now, when I look at her, she has got this thing, you can't quite see the top, but there's a brush. That's her brush that she's been painting those paintings with. And look at her arms. And what she has done is she has taken the energy of her physical energy and also the energy of the flowers that she has remembered perhaps from her garden. And she has painted her room, bringing these things into structures. And I sort of see her and I think of her kids coming in there and saying, really, Mom, why do you spend all your time in there with that stupid brush? and I don't think she would say anything except, hmm. But if she could, I think she would probably say, and I'm not being denigrating, I think she would just consider that comment beneath contempt. I think she would say that she was doing several things. She's bringing the flowers in for the winter. It's a cold country, probably, I think, Poland, Russia, Bulgaria. And that she has made patterns that are satisfying to her. And not only, you can see in the mirror, the corners of the room, there's a repetition of motifs around and around there. She's given herself a structure that she likes, a repetition and a cyclic structure. And you can see that repeated in the lace that's on the mantelpiece, which she's probably made herself too. It isn't that it means anything, it's something that she's created. And we say to ourselves, on the one hand you can say she's bringing all that energy and putting it into a structure and making a meaning for herself. And maybe we might ask also, this is just a decorative instinct. What does it mean? I mean, look at all those quilts back there and look at that wallpaper. It's a good idea that women have got that kind of thing to keep themselves busy, you know, and keep their mouths shut. I think you have to see it in another way, and that there is a terrific urge for structure and meaning taking place here. And it isn't meaning that can be translated into truth. The turkey trot quilt and the double duck's foot and the Kansas star and the double wedding ring don't say anything that can be translated. They are, and they represent things that recur in patterns and energy brought into art. Okay, can we go to the next one? The expression of the spiritual dimension is in religious feelings, an experience of awe, serenity, reverence, joy, love, hope, acceptance, and a knowledge of unity. These eggs are painted by Ukrainians living in Minnesota. Bozhi Blashavi Pomotsi, the woman prays as she sits down to make these eggs, God bless and help us. And my National Geographic adds, because I managed to find this page, as her sun-worshipping, S-U-N, sun-worshipping ancestors decorated eggs in joy at the rebirth of the spring, so she commemorates the rebirth of man. It is a work of worship to make these. Now, I don't think the little explanations here are too legible, but this here says waves and ribbons circling an egg without beginning or end suggest eternity. And you can see that the basic design that the women and girls are putting on these eggs have to do with patterns recurring around and around and around, waves and designs. And these are very similar to embroidery designs that you see in a lot of decorative art. The deer and the other animals of the cartoon signify prosperity. It also shows the kind of thing that people in the pre-Christian era depended on to live, And up there, see that white deer? Maybe he's Fun Lover's white deer. Remember Fun Lover who came and talked to us? Or maybe it's Terry Lawrence's caribou. But there he is. These dots depict stars in the heavens and also recall Mary's tears. This will happen all the time. There will be something pre-Christian, and then there will be a Christian overlay to it. That's called syncretism, when a primitive pagan symbol is used in a Christian way. The dots, here are some. Now, how are you going to know that those are Mary's tears or stars in the heaven? But they do, they are put there to represent that. A perfect example of syncretism is the Ukrainian cross. They accepted Christianity in 988, and this eight-pointed star, which was the sign of the sun god, S-U-N, became the symbol of the S-O-N, symbol of Christ. Two more obviously pagan symbols, the wheat sheaf and the fish, become representative of Christian ideas to Christ as the fish, Ichthus, from the initials of his name. We talked a lot about Easter eggs on Easter, but I think you can see that the decorative instinct here has become really spiritual, and the feeling of awe and reverence is there. Okay, can we have it? Now, this is a tapestry that Regina managed to lose the original home. So I think it's about 14th century. And I think this is a very good illustration of what I mean by syncretism when it has to do with the figure of the woman. Mary was not worshipped in pre-Christian Europe. Various different women figures, goddesses, were Nertha in Germany, Bridget in Brittany, Annis in Carmarthenshire, A-N-N-I-S, who later was degraded to the blue hag of Carmarthenshire, who ate her children and hung their skins on a tree. They were degraded later and called witches. Danai in Ireland. It goes all the way around the world. There's a circumpolar worship. Venus, Aphrodite, Artemis, Demeter, Persephone. Well, here's a European tapestry. Jira, I think it says Jira Monsol Desir, which is a good thing she's put it there, because absolutely everything else in there is a symbol of the goddess. Notice the symmetry, by the way. I sound like Joe Waffman, but he's inspired me. The thing that they're sitting on looks like it's probably a merry-go-round. The island, the revolving islands of women off the coast of England, were considered to be heaven. The island of Avalon, where Arthur was sent to when he died, remember, in a boat. The island of Bran, in another medieval song. These islands were populated by women, and the women had wonderful gifts that they usually carried in a casket or a bowl. And anybody who came to the island would be given a gift by one of the maidens of the queen on the island, and whatever they asked for would come out of the bowl. They would be met at the shore, and there would be these maidens holding golden bowls, and they would say, "I want prosperity," and they would have prosperity. "I want something to eat," and they would have something to eat. The bowls were never empty. It was like the cornucopia. And then one day, somebody came to the island and systematically raped the maidens. And that having been done, the golden bowl was empty and the land was laid waste. Now that's the origin of the Grail legends, but it also comes up in the worship of the goddess and is the origin of the idea of the cauldron, which was degraded into the witch's cauldron. The unicorn is associated in England with the goddess. The fruitful trees, always. There are no snakes and no atoms around those trees. They're found also in Eastern embroidery, always surrounding the goddess. The lion that she's got tamed, he turns up on the tarot card too as a symbol of strength. Everything is circular. And the most obvious way of knowing that this is the goddess is the three moons. She's always in three phases of the moon. The virgin huntress, the mother, and the final one, which got degraded into the death symbol, is actually the state of life of a woman when she has enough sense to kick her children out of the house, to let them. The virgin huntress, before she's married, very athletic. The bountiful mother is the second phase of the moon, the full moon. And then the waning moon, letting go. So you've got a monkey. You can see an Eastern influence here. All kinds of poetry. And you wonder what women were wondering when they worked and worked and worked on these. Were they worshiping themselves for a change? I think they probably were. Okay. Now, let's see. Okay. Things that go in circles. The island in that flat tapestry you can see looked like it was going to go around in a circle. Well, an even better way to get that idea of something eternally circling is to paint a painting onto a jar or a piece of pottery. Now, this one is an amphora from 350 to 370 BC. It's Greek. And what you have are athletes who in ancient Greece always used to run around naked. Ancient Greece, of course, classical Greece, the only passion of love was between men. The women were kept in the houses, and men were forced to marry them at the age of 30 in order to have sons for the state. So there they all are, running around. But the feminist point is not the important one. Do you remember Keats' ode on a Grecian errand where there is somebody always just about to be kissed and never going to be kissed, and so for 700, 800, 900 years, they're going to be always just about to be kissed? This is the same idea. Always just about to finish the race, always in motion, a tremendous sense of energy, and then repeated up at the top in the patterns, just plain repetitive motifs that don't mean anything, they just celebrate something. This is probably, you know, used for oil to put on the athletes who oiled themselves before they ran around naked. Okay. The next one. This one kind of gives me the creeps. It's a dragon, or I think a snake with a tail in his mouth. And this is made in the 1920s in a Pueblo village in New Mexico by a woman named Maria Martinez. Maria Martinez made the pot, and her husband made the decoration, which I think is kind of nice. Myths are a collective expression of the same deep wisdom, using people, animals, and events to evoke feelings which are true of our deepest cultural experience. That dragon or snake running around trying to catch his own tail is called Ouroboros in ancient mythology, and he's all over the place. He's in Greek mythology and Persian mythology. It's a symbol of eternity. He never catches his tail. Or sometimes you see him with his tail in his mouth. And that's a wonderful symbol of something that keeps on going. Here on a jar, it's running around. In Norse mythology, it's the Midangiard serpent, who is the ocean circling the earth. The reason I said this one depresses me is it came on a postcard, which was my last communication from a graduate student of mine who proceeded to commit suicide by drowning herself because she didn't get tenure at the University of Hawaii. Anyway, so it depresses me. On to something more cheerful. Now, these are the Calden slides from Chartres Cathedral. And the whole subject of Chartres is an interesting one because I think we tend to think of it as a product of an immensely sophisticated civilization, which of course it is, in the 12th century. And we don't usually think of Chartres Cathedral as being a pagan place, but it is built in a grove that was sacred to the Druids, and if you've been there, you'll know that the huge arches as you walk up the aisle look like elm trees, enormous elm trees. And it's absolutely filled with syncretism or pagan nature imageries used in a Christian way and sometimes not even quite as Christian as you might think. Now this is the North Rose Window, which is called the Rose of France, and I found a description of it in Henry Adams' book, Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres. The Virgin is at the center. Let's see if I can. Okay. Right in the middle there, Virgin Mary. And she's got a number of, look at the pattern too here, recurrent, just plain abstract pattern. But inside those medallions are some doves, which are the symbols of Venus. But now they're going to be the symbols of Mary and the Holy Ghost. And there are two sets of angels. Four with six wings, who were called thrones. Remember, cherubims and thrones. Four angels with six wings and four lower angels. And then around those, she's got 12 medallions of the kings of Judah. And around those, she's got a circle of 12 prophets. The whole thing is in the shape of a circle, or is called a rose window. And the rose, the open rose, not what we think of as the American beauty rose, which is a closed virginal object, but an open rose, which is, guess what, symbolizes in Europe and in the East as the open lotus, complete wisdom, absolute maturity, complete wisdom, everything there. Now, the amazing thing about this one, from the point of view of syncretism, with which, of course, I'm completely obsessed, is that that figure in the middle, got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 windows, and the one in the middle at the bottom, the most prominent one, is not, as you might think, Mary with Jesus. That is Mary's mother, Saint Anne, with Mary. In other words, the old Demeter Persephone, mother and daughter, has replaced the mother and son, a chakra, which is rather appropriate. So I say there's a lot of pre-Christian symbolism floating around that cathedral. And she's got her court. Mary has her court. She's got Solomon, Aaron, David, and Melchizedek, from right to left. And each of them is stepping on the head of his enemy. David is stepping on Saul. I'm not quite sure who everybody's stepping on. But it's a very triumphant thing. And you can see that the builders of Chartres now are expressing really almost a mathematical idea about the way light and energy are going to be contained in color and pattern for the purposes of worship. Can I have the next one? This one I'm not so brilliant on because I don't have dinner yet. Do the Colleagues remember? Yeah, this is the west window of Chartres, and I'm just not 100% sure what it depicts, so I'll tell you something else about Chartres. the thing is, the whole of the cathedral is built on the east, with the altar to the east. This is the west window. You can see the light is slightly dimmer. Northwest, east, and south. And according to one student of Chartres I checked with, the entire structure of the Chartres Cathedral was controlled and inspired by a Platonic Pythagorean concept of the laws of number governing the universe. In other words, they were worshiping using their idea of the most advanced mathematics of the time. By these laws made audible in music and visible in architecture, the soul is brought to accord with both its own spiritual nature and the universal ground. For in the words of John of Salisbury, Bishop of Chartres from 1176 to 78, the soul is said to be composed of musical consonances. Soul of prairie is the chicken buckers and the recorder group, right? And then the shape of the The heavenly spheres are harmonized and the cosmos governed as well as man. We are to recognize, Campbell concludes, translated into stone and stained glass in the noble Gothic visions of those ritually inspired years, both a model of the cosmos as the Middle Ages perceived it and a model of the Christian soul in accord. Okay, can we have the next one? I hope you notice the syncretism going on between me and Jeff Hoffman. One person absorbing the other's techniques. This is something that may have fallen down last week because there was an earthquake near there. This is the Byzantine mosaic dome looking up, you're lying flat on your back, of St. Marco in Venice. And it's another example of containing the cosmos in color and circular patterns. This one works counterclockwise for some reason I don't understand, from the middle, depicting the scenes of creation. Now we're likely to say to ourselves, this point, what is all this about Christian souls and medieval cathedrals? I mean, what are we involved in? A kind of nostalgie de la Vierge, which is a wonderful French expression for wishing you were a virgin again. Otherwise known as nostalgia for a more simple time when we believed in souls. We at Prairie have no church. We have no structures. We have no rigid forms. These institutionalized myths make us suspicious. We do not want our beliefs to be rigidified into structures. We are a breakthrough people. We are a patchwork quilt. We're a moving kaleidoscope. What has all this got to do with us? And if you put the next one, I'm going to answer my dreadful rhetorical questions with a personal statement. This is one that Ruth gave me too, an Austrian 14th century Schlosskapelle at Ibrockstorp. Love Lily Pagan. The sun, the moon, and the stars, which got me wanting to explain to you something. What has this got to do with prairie? What have these slides got to do with prairie? We're not this kind of a people. Well, I guess it was the sun, moon, and stars that got me started. But I wrote a poem in a state of complete gloom in the summer of 1967 during the Jerusalem War. And it was about the sheet meadow where the Israelis and Jews of New York were dancing with the red drum, celebrating the Sharm el-Sheikh victory, where the hippies were having a good time together, and where I described myself as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and in the last stanza as a wasp. It's called Sheet Meadow Blues, and it's the most gloomy poem I ever wrote, and I want to contrast it to how I feel about Curry. In a ring of boulders, hourglass drum necks syncopate, glazed hips responding to the dancers packing the park dust into a hora. Man and woman, child, grandmother and cousin, exultant for Sharm el-Sheikh, for Jerusalem leaping, regenerating a people out of the Sabbath. I have not a thread of color for their circle. When I go upon the sheet meadow, I curse my people. Upon the meadow where the dry grass nests them, there are those leaning each to each speechless, a mute concordance woven of Sabbath couples. Covered over with hair, bells, capes, and curtains, their shoulders move to inarticulate ragas. Sun, moon, and stars wheel into their phylacteries. There is a sweet smell upon the Sunday meadow. There was nothing to But I am hung upon such sober logic as white, like black, is not a color. Anglo is what the Puerto Ricans call me. Saxon, a brutal posse that lynched the Druids. Protestant, the rub is walking naked, naked of leather sandals, bells, and curtains, naked of incense, naked of candelabra, having known all the postures of the Kama Sutra, our thighs burn white through merely human lovers. When I go upon the sheet meadow, I remember precisions of gilded houses, Florentine carvings in the great hall at Plymouth, ceilings wrought in god-white circles and boxes, tall brocade chairs at dinner, and that tall woman carved in like her highboy into a Gothic stalwart, and at her feet the worm-pocked breasted satyrs. I remember my grandmother's statue, Mussolini. The horror is stilled. Wine is passed over blankets. The hippies are laying their necks on each other like kittens. A police force is cantering, turning his separate buttocks, each circling each in mammalian concordance. But I have seen a wasp, his arsenic thorax nourished in many rooms of ashen mansions, come to the quick in a starving caterpillar. When I go upon the sheet meadow, I curse my people. Well, what I'm trying to say is that prairie are people. There are things that they do together. Would you do the next one? When Ruth and George showed their slides of Galilee, Ruth was kind of commenting on the Christian aspects, and George was kind of commenting on the Jewish aspects, and they are our people. Do you want to do the next one? Now, here are some people doing something that prairie people might like to do someday. They're moving a neighbor's house. That's kind of nice. These are Dorsey people in Ethiopia, and they build these houses. These people are weavers, and they weave fences and they weave houses. And these houses last for 50 years. And if they keep moving them from place to place, and if they don't move from place to place, their houses don't last because you're going to get a flood and the ground is going to get to be inadequate. Or you want to move the whole village to a place where you can use the house to cultivate your garden, so you want to move someplace else. So these are people who have to move in order to survive. And it doesn't say so in the National Geographic, but you just know they're all about to sing a moving song. And what we're going to get to in a minute is trying to plan a moving ritual for those who are leaving us. this summer, and I thought this kind of symbolized that whole process. Okay, next one. Well, prairie people like to move. That's a year ago, last weekend, on the Kickapoo River. And prairie people also like to eat. We have things that we do. We're not, because we're unstructured and because each of us believes a different thing, doesn't mean that there aren't things that we do. And we try not to be too articulate about it because it takes the doing away. But we do go through things like the two deaths this year and the movings that are going to take place, and suffering, and illness, and recovery, and sometimes not recovery, and the little deaths of moving. And we celebrate what other people celebrate, rebirth, and a sense of goodness, and a sense of peoplehood. And I don't feel any longer that I curse my people, because I think I've found one. And what we're going to do now, if you turn on the light, is to have a two-part discussion. Anybody not know who those people are? Okay. We're going to have a two-part discussion. First, anything that you want to bring up about these ideas, led by me. And second part of the discussion is going to have to do with what we're going to do next week for our final service. Those things on the board are just suggestions. And then we have more. So we will have a discussion on that.
Yes. Oh.
Yeah. Not to quarrel with what you said when you began, but to point out that when you were discussing the possibility of life in other places, there was
it goes on and on about the flowers coming up and everything, you know, to the tune of Good King Wenceslas. And then I just doubled up at the end because it says, what if the two lines about life is built on reason? Reason rules the intellect, life is built on reason. The little Unitarian tail wagging the dog. Yeah. Thoughts about this last week, specifically this week, and in general.
There's an old expression, a Bach paper talks about science leading to the disenchantment of the world. I don't know if it's better in Germany.
How does it go, Jim?
The imagination of the world. And your examples suggest that science shows the world to be detached in all sorts of ways. But if you look at the other translation, the imagination of the world, it's a different thing. And I'm not so sure that science doesn't show the world as a kind of mechanism independent of us. Okay?
Except
so
for the
myth,
yeah.
People who are really believed in this believe that the world or things out there have a kind of personality. So the people who made the shark. But if they could really communicate with what followers, there are people like Saint Francis. And there were people who believed that by consulting astrologers, they could make the right decision at the right time, among other things. And I suspect there are people here who talk to their followers.
I just talked to them. Oh, dear, excuse me.
Not to open.
Dan Willard, but deer hunting or mark hunting, and they came in dark subtle, died at his house beforehand in order to attract them. I think he was breaking the rules. I'm just expressing it.
Did he do that?
My ambivalence about mystics.
Well, your question.
Are there really any mystics around the, or is it a kind of poetry?
You're making the dichotomy between mysticism and poetry. And you're making a statement about insanity, meaning beyond reason.
But is he insane if he paints cattails on the side of his canoe so he can't see it?
Who does? I have a camouflage canoe. I think, Warren, the only problem is that science seems to know, and you're using magic, you know, in a negative sense, and yet what keeps happening is the things you used to think are magic, like, for example, if you eat hollyhock leaves when you're menstruating too much, it will stop. Now, women have known that forever. We've lost the knowledge, and we've gained it again. Well, you go to the chemist, and you tell them to give you the chemical components of hollyhock leaves, you come out with something that, you know. A lot of the magic is scientific. The magic was an intuitive grasp of scientific fact before the scientists came along to help us. So we need both. You know, they work together. Barbara?
I thought that there are... I'm into this at the moment because for me, brought me this wonderful book that's and it's called Lives of a Cell, which sounds pretty prosaic, right? And it's, there are people like those Thomas who wrote that and like Warren Isley who, it seems to me, remystify. The whole tenor of Thomas's book has to do with talking about consciousness, and not only consciousness, but physical being. He starts off with the statement that the mitochondria in your cells are more like free living bacteria than they are like the rest of you. And that they probably didn't grow there, they were not generated from within, but from without. And he starts talks about himself as a collection of bacteria running a typewriter, which is kind of...
Well, do the bacteria talk about him?
Well, he wonders about that, and he also goes into the problem of things like beehives, because a single bee is just as dead as a single cell. It's got to have the whole mechanism and the whole structure.
Yeah, but you ought to add that Lewis Thomas is probably one of the most respected biologists.
Sure. National Academy.
That's interesting. The scientific basis of this, there's a children's book by Madeline Lengel, which is really an adult book, which is about the cells of a little boy who's got something wrong with his cells. And the cells are conscious, and they have to improve their quality of ethical behavior in order for the little boy to survive. It sounds crazy, but it's an absolute.
Oh, and there's a passage in Warren Isley, which I don't remember where it is, it just really wiped me out, where he falls down on the sidewalk and has a nosebleed. Lying there thinking about the cells that he's dropped on the ground and they're going to die, and it was his job to protect them. Well, it's heartbreaking. Every time he goes by, he walks by the stain on the sidewalk, and this is terrible.
Oh my. Well,
one can go both directions, in and out.
Well, you can see why the Warren uses the word insanity, because. You know, it's a little difficult. There's a kind of zany, poetic, fun-lovingness, which is healthy, and then there's insanity, which is dreadful. And it's too bad to mix the one up, the good part, the creative part of the psychosis, you know, the psychosis is horrible. It's kind of insane. Yeah.
I wonder if there's
a
problem with sticking consciousness or being is into it, writing into it, is something too. And I think in scientific thought very often, or at least in academia, gets the idea we're just thinking. It's like the whole thing is nothing but thought, continuous thought, and that's the end all.
So Mary Lou was calling the left side of the brain getting away from
Never mind which side is which. Tim Dale turned me on to this after reading something in the Scientific American, but apparently one side of our brain does control verbal things, and the other side sees shapes and has awareness without words. And for most of us, there's a very clear dominance of the verbal side. But in a few cases, you have people who, where there's not that dominance. And their awareness of the nonverbal side of their brain may be for them quite disturbing and confusing, and it may also lead to I'm putting this on it. This wasn't in the article, but I can see how a person who doesn't have this full dominance of the verbal side may indeed be a person who perceives things in ways, and the rest of us call them crazy.
Yeah, I think the best example for that is Einstein. Talk until he was five, but always thought in shapes. His whole thought process was always shapes and abstract things in metal language wise.
Virginia Woolf didn't talk until she was 4 or 5.
When I had that awful flu this winter and my fever was soaring, and I was trying to keep things under control by writing a journal, I wrote, I must not stay sane, and I must not go too crazy.
Yeah,
that's the real thing.
Well, I'm reading a dissertation this weekend, which is about rigid cell structures versus the open mind, and there is a tremendous problem with this, because I mean, I know if I get super tired, I get a chaotic bombardment of impressions, and it's very, very frightening. And on the other hand, the response of buttoning your personality up into an iron vest so that nothing can penetrate that's unusual, which is a very frequent human response, I feel would be also destructive. So it's that kind of thin edge of the wedge as to how you're going to walk through the world. We are all probably in some ways threatened with too many sense impressions, too many impressions coming to us. We have to sort them out. And a lot of people just decide to button up. It's a kind of walking autism. Because it's too frightening to let any impressions. Trees, and then they look at the world from the point of view of the tree. There's a lot of that going on in women's literature. I think probably a great deal going on in men's literature too. But that is a poet's
thing. One of the difficulties that we have with magic and interpreting especially things from other cultures which tell you why, you know,
I think the birds inside the house, I mean, you know, they don't get a range of what they're done, kind of thing. And the disservice that's been done to us by anthropology, which attempted to translate the content of other cultures into the most dry aspects of our own culture, so that everything was mechanistic. All the translations came out in our language in the most consistent, dry, mechanistic language that we had. And now we're reacting to that and saying, no, we want to get the real stuff. And we're willing to accept almost any kind of nonsense as the real stuff because we're so anxious to get out of that very rigid translation that we were stuck with when we first discovered those cultures. And I think that the truth is somewhere else.
Yeah, in between.
I don't know if it's in between, because that, again, is within the rigid framework, and I don't like that. But it's somewhere else. Because though some of those things that you point out are explanations. They do explain cause and effect.
Well, sure. I mean, for example, in hunting, to use that example again, if you go out there and imitate a moose, now, you can call that sympathetic magic if you want, but if you sound horny enough, it'll compliment it. I mean, yeah. I mean, it really is useful. And who knows that those paintings in the caves aren't paintings of the right posture to get yourself into in order to stab the right place on the animal that's painted in the cave. I mean, I don't know.
I was once out in the desert with a German botanist who was serious. Big deal, big botanist. And we had found a plant. And we looked at it and we were saying, they're hard to key, and we had the things out. And he picked it up and he said, it speaks to me of scabiosa. And he's right.
This is very serious. You've got to have that kind of speaking if you're going to eat mushrooms. Now we're going to have a transition.
Okay, transition.
See what we're going to do.
A couple of things from Unitarianism, or from the way Unitarianism has impinged on me, make me comfortable with the diversity of points of view. One of them is, and this is older than the Prairie Society, that I see it as a Unitarian idea, that of having respect for other people's beliefs. And the way I saw it, for instance, in the Sunday school back at the First Church, was that there was a real honoring of other people's beliefs. It wasn't a mere perfunctory respect. It was like when they did the Seder in the fifth grade, and I was helping you. Oh no, somebody else. But anyway, we were really doing a Seder. And anyway, that respecting of other people's beliefs, and then at the Y, when the Prairie Society had the Hindu spokesman, he made the point of how in Hinduism, it's assumed that everybody's beliefs are true, that people have different portions of the truth. And I think he may have used that story about the blind man and the elephant, and how one said the elephant is like a rope because he had a hold of the tail. Somebody else said the elephant is like a snake, he had a hold of the trunk. And there was one who thought the elephant was a wall, he had the side of the elephant. And the tree, that was the leg of the elephant. And the Hindu point is that all these things are true. And so I'm really comfortable with the idea that I can believe a lot of things and my beliefs are true, and the fact that other people believe things that seem inconsistent, that really doesn't bother me too much, because I can accept that their beliefs are true too. They just have, like this Hindu man was pointing out, they have a different piece of the truth from my piece of the truth, and they're probably all okay. Now, the transition thing to the discussion of next week, Annis's ministry has been built around ritual, and I brought in some things from Anna Halperin about ritual. And I'm going to review them real quickly, and then we should talk about next week's ritual. Anna says that rituals may symbolize moments in our lives that have to do with growth and change. She spoke of eating as a ritual that symbolizes joining and coming together, and also the ritual placement, which used to be Father at the head of the table, affected our whole view of ourselves. And then in her process of groups collectively building rituals, she says selectivity is important. The rituals need to be reevaluated and recycled. She says there's a process of selectivity that goes on within a group of people. It's important that the rituals are reevaluated and recycled till they get to the point where they can be accepted and are selected by the community. And she also says the individuals will say, this is what I like, this is what I didn't like, this is what my experience was. If I were to do it again, I would want to do this. You go through the reevaluation of what worked, what didn't work. What were some of your experiences? Well, let's do it next time in a different way. Now we have other resources. Let's add, let's take out. And the recycling eventually brings you to something that's meaningful for the whole group. The important is that we know that at any time we can add or subtract. She says the moment a ritual becomes static, it's going to become empty, because if it's too rigid, it's not inclusive enough and doesn't allow for the now. In planning for our final ceremony, we're at the moment that comes every year in Prairie, where we know that some people are going to move away from Madison, and we won't be seeing those people very much anymore. It's a moment in our group life which has to do with growth and change. Next week will be a leave-taking, and perhaps our ritual can symbolize the goodness of what we've shared together, what we've meant to each other, or it may symbolize how we deal with farewells, how each of us experiences the leave-taking. We can recycle things from past Prairie programs. We can change them. We can make up new things. And this is the point at which Anna's take over.
Well, it's just a couple of ideas about what we might do. And these are just suggestions. And you tell me that this is what you want to do.
Anna, can you pull that around? Yeah.
Sure, I'm coming. Now the Ron Slaybaugh and Pat Johnson will be moving away, and I don't know if there are others here who will be moving, but they should definitely let us know. And one thing we thought of asking those people to do is to bring something that you're going to take to remind you of Madison, some token that you're going to take away and talk about it. That was just an idea. Now, we also found in something that one of you gave us, I think Paula Elkins, the idea that everybody in the congregation might bring a card. We have some, don't we, to give out?
We will.
Oh, we will next week. And on that, you write a present to give to somebody else who's there that day. You might write a diamond necklace. You might write, I hope you find 25 morel mushrooms. You might write something that is a wish. And we'll put those, here's the idea, and you tell me if you like this, we'll put those on a table up here. And then we'll take the people who are moving away and have them lead the shaker dance, take my hands in brotherly love, take my hands in sisterly love, and recycle that, which we all like, until everybody has passed through the circle, all holding the hands and taking a gift from the table. Now that involves some recycling, because when we did it the first time, we didn't all get to go and hold everybody's hands. We didn't quite get it. The groups didn't kind of all the way go around. Now is that something that would be an all right
set of rituals, or do people have suggestions about the whole moving idea? Of course, we can't pick up their house and move them the way the Dorothy tribesmen did. If other people who are going to, yeah.
I remember one meeting, people with that surrender girl gave each other nicknames that I recall as being their real names. Some dolly or the Houstons, we would all know each other well enough to give each other
nicknames. To give nicknames to specific people?
Yes, and especially the children. I think they were really excited because they wanted to know.
Mm-hmm. I think you could, how did you do that? I wasn't there when you did that. Did you also stand around and...
I don't know. What's the reason
why
that
you
did
that? Yeah.
We were told to pick out someone and talk to them that we had to talk to or do the prayer for about 5 minutes. Conversation, give them a name. And,
any name at all?
Name, like,
that would, okay, let's put that down on our list of possibilities. Yeah.
Well, it strikes me that none of us know for certain that we're going to be together in September.
Other people besides the ones that are moving.
Yeah.
What they would take with them if they were to
move.
We're
all going to go.
And we're going for the summer. Okay, that would simply add, there was something we had here that people might think of coming with an idea to talk about that would be a peak experience or a mystical experience that they might have had that they would like to share, or an entirely different thing, a memory of saying goodbye from a community or from a place or that they had remembered, or we can add a memory from Prairie, and we'll just sit around and do these.
I don't want to say goodbye, I want to say so
long. Okay, good. Well, now that in and of itself is a distinction. Yeah. If we're going to recycle the Take My Hands and Brotherly Love and Sisterly Love, we had that with the Shape Note singers singing. Should we do that again or should we all sing it? Do you have any suggestions?
We can all sing it.
We can all sing it. So that you just had to sing and sing and sing and sing, and this time it'll be more because everybody is going to touch everybody before we're through with this ritual. Okay, of course you can't eat 3x5 cards. is anybody interested in food? I didn't put that down.
That's a
crackers. Okay, we're going to get involved in food. I'm not quite sure. Do people want to bring something to eat or not? I mean, how do people feel about that? We're having the picnic the next week. Shall we eat 3x5s? Okay. There was the simple gifts thing that Mark Marilu and I did in our very first service, and I don't know if you'd like to do that again as a dance, where we sang simple gifts and we walked around and around. That's just a suggestion I'm throwing out if anybody's interested in doing it. Or is Hermine here? Maybe some of the dances. Yeah. Are there some of the dances that you did? The one you did, I can't remember the name of it, on Easter, where it was kind of like a patchwork quilt. There were four people
gathering
peace cups, and the men would come in and walk out, and then the women would come in and walk out. It was very interesting. It was like that double marriage ring thing. Do you have some dances that you would like to do? Could we do gathering peace cups again?
Sure.
That would be good. Put that down so I'll remember what we're doing. I'm going to forget everything.
I don't feel very tentative about dancing. I know I'm
going to
do it with some people or will want to be that
program.
And I think it should be kind of free for those who wish.
All right, towards the end then, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. We do have teacher recognition, and somebody is in charge of that, I think. Yeah.
Are we going to circulate those 3x5s around?
What are we going to do with that?
We were going to suggest that some of you may, during the week, take a piece of paper and write a gift on it and bring it along. But since there will be people who didn't get around to it, we'll have 3x5s and pencils, which everybody can get a hold of and quickly write a gift to add to the table.
Okay, I had it wrong. Just bring.
Is just one person going to get that?
Everybody will get to pick something off the table.
Everybody will, but the people who are moving will help first.
So write down 2 or 3 gifts if you can, and put them on separate pieces of paper.
Oh, do you sign your name to them and make good?
We hadn't thought of that. Do you think we should?
Wonderful story. Okay.
So sign your name to it, and then when people pick up their mushrooms or their necklace, they'll know who gave it to them.
It's a wonderful story. The church where they did this, a very distinguished aristocratic lady got a diamond necklace from a little girl who kept walking around and asking, did you like my diamond necklace? And she said, oh yes, I really like your diamond necklace.
Can you put that
I think so, yeah.
What was it?
To read out what their gifts are. We do figure out
if there's time. It depends.
I don't want just one person to get what I want to get.
Well, then make out 150. I see your point. A wish, it could be a wish for the whole group.
Well, perhaps part of that discussion where you offered 3 topics, people who wanted to could read their gift. That makes a fourth topic for
That's
your
a good
discussion.
Idea. Yeah, but then you might bring a peak experience, you might bring an experience of saying goodbye, you might bring a shalom, or read your card. Let's see, Chicken Fuckers are going to do their own thing. They've offered to do that, and that's going to be a mystery until we find out what it is. Chalices, Mike? Are you giving out chalices? Okay, that would be in fun. And the children did make some prairie totem poles, which we will bring up. So those are the ideas. There'll be, I'm going to find that hymn, On Our Way Rejoicing, Gladly Let Us Go, and rewrite it into Unitarian ease. I hope. I don't think it's in the book. Any other ideas for next week? It's a lot. Okay, now we're going to end with 2 musical of the spheres. pieces. The first is The Beggar's Opera by the Reporter Group, is that right? Is that the correct title for the piece? The Overture to the Beggar's Opera, Afro Beggars. Thank you.
great. I played them really in Georgia. They're far out record. Yeah. You remember what they were? Out of the intellect, scientific knowledge, everything has to add up bag. And at the same time, when she started to discuss extraterrestrials and the possibility of our not being the center of the universe, she bought, without thinking, the idea that if there's something out there, it's probably smarter than we are. And by that, she was buying the whole big, better, best, smartest continuum, which is the essence of the Protestant ethic and of the evolutionary theory and of the scientific method. And it might well be that the things which are, I need to borrow that for a week and I'll bring it back, thank you. It might well be that the thing that we ought to be thinking about is things which have a greater capacity in other ways than we do. The capacity for joy or just sheer biological energy, perhaps the capacity to reproduce. And we, you know, we speculate occasionally about the insects making it more than we do. And the only time, do you remember the Hellstrom Chronicle? It was a movie. And it's the only thing I've ever seen which depicted a science fiction being which made it over man without being smarter than he was. In the Hellstrom Chronicle, the insects make it by sheer reproductive energy. They just take over. And, well, occasionally a Star Trek incident will be like that. Something will just have so much energy that it threatens to swallow the ship. But usually what happens in science fiction is that the thing is smarter. And that's really our direct outgrowth of our whole big, better, best thing.
You also said it was a Unitarian idea.
Sure, because we're the most intellectual of Protestants.
Yeah, I was really interested. That's why I wanted to get that on tape, because it was a fascinating thought.
Well, you can do a lot of things with that linear concept. It's a medieval concept originally, starting with God, and then the angels, and then man, and then the animals. And then it was borrowed into evolutionary theory, so that man is the crowning product of evolution. So it made it into Protestantism and into big, better, best, that
and
way.
Into science.
But and now, you know, in trying to get out of that, we're trying very hard to create some ideas about what is possible and what is good, which are multifaceted, and yet Anna fell right back into it without realizing it. And she said,
when she read that stuff in the humanist. You were saying some stuff about anthropology being written and very translated, the ideas of
anthropology wants to be a science.
Yeah.
And so when it goes about to translate the meaning of one culture into another culture, into our culture, it prides itself on being precise and on making its explanations coherent in its scientific theory. So that the anthropologist, up until Carlos Pastrana, who is an anthropologist, and there were some hints of it earlier, like it is said that one of Margaret Mead's husbands died of witchcraft, and Margaret Mead may have been involved in herself. But it's usual what happens. In order to make it in anthropology, you have to give up that kind of perception. And you have to be willing to
outside the
culture you're translating into the mechanistic, rationalist kind of it all fits together and it's all explained.
Usually it's all got to have a purpose in productive terms too, like...
Right. All of the aspects of the culture have to be shown to be useful in the kind of, okay, good, in the kind of Protestant economic, the saved always, their fortunes are saved too.
like this idea of painting the deer on the side of the pickup truck would have to be explained in terms of less so I'll get more deer.
Yeah, and not just that I'm really into deer this year. And I'll get so into deer that when I actually see the deer, he and I will become one and we'll be connected by the arrow. You know, which is much more, I think, the kind of thing, and probably does in fact have the kind of, because as I think Anna's pointed out, you get so into the deer that you go into its anatomy and you know at the moment you need to know where to in the arrow to get the deer. How we quickly we slip back into the mechanistic explanation.
Yeah.
We really want that to be true, that, you know, somehow it can all be explained and it all makes it work better.
Yeah. That's neat. How do you happen to know about anthropology?
I was married to one for 20 years.
I see. So you observed it.
The dimensions of mysticism. To weed out the shooks on the Sanola, as they say.
Well, that's a job that I'm certainly not up to. In fact, for several weeks working with Annis, I said, that's one word I can't deal with. I don't know what mysticism means.
Well, I could understand it could be very pleasant to have a ceremony about hollyhock as a curative thing. But if I have an infection, I'd much rather take antibiotics than examine the entrails in a day or something. See what I mean?
Well, you're saying some things will work for you, some things won't.
Right. So, yeah, in other words, when the chips are down, I'd rather not fool around with the entrails of the day, but if I want to have fun and a charge and a good feeling or a community feeling, we can play around with the entrails of the day. But that element of subjective truth, you see what I mean, on the feeling, experience level.